For anyone curious about what might happen in the next election cycle, writer Dan Kaufman says you need to look no further than our neighbor to the north. In his new book, The Fall of Wisconsin, he traces how that state's progressive legacy was dismantled by a new wave of conservatism.
The state became called what Louis Brandeis, the Supreme Court Justice, called a laboratory of democracy. And it was probably the premier laboratory of democracy in the country.
And here in Illinois, Governor Rauner vetoes a bill that would have prohibited Illinois from participating in a controversial interstate voter database. We check in with the State Board of Elections on that and the Illinois angle to the recent Russia indictments. Plus, this week marks 50 years since the first Special Olympics was held at Soldier Field in Chicago. We look back at the history of the Special Olympics with founder and Illinois Supreme Court Justice Ann Burke. That's coming up later this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey, in for Nyla Boodoo. Coming up later in the show, Governor Rauner's decision to veto a bill that would have gotten the state out of a controversial voter database, and we'll look back on 50 years of the Special Olympics. But first, think back to November 2016. You probably remember where you were on that election night, but were you focused on Wisconsin? A lot of political observers overlooked the state. Candidate Hillary Clinton was confident she'd win. Wisconsin hadn't gone for a Republican candidate for president since 1984. But in a night of surprises, Wisconsin was called for Donald Trump. And as went Wisconsin, so went the nation. So what happened to this once Democratic stronghold? Liberal icon Russ Feingold lost twice, while conservative Congressman Paul Ryan rose to be Speaker of the House. What lessons can the rest of us learn from our neighbor to the north? Those are questions journalist and Wisconsin native Dan Kaufman tackles in his new book, The Fall of Wisconsin. Dan's on the line with me now from New York. Hello, Dan. Welcome to the 21st.
Hello, Brian. Thank you for having me.
I want to begin by asking you about this idea of Wisconsin as a laboratory for the rest of the country. How so?
Well, in the early 20th century, the progressive movement was very strong in Wisconsin. In fact, it was spearheaded there. There was a famous senator and governor named Robert La Follette that championed legislation that would benefit the citizens as a whole. I'll give you an example. The first workers' compensation bill was passed in Wisconsin in 1911. Before that, if a worker died on the job, there was no recourse for his family. His wife would be widowed, and his children would be maybe have to live with a relative. So they addressed these sort of problems that were systemic from sort of unregulated capitalism. They pioneered the idea of social insurance. The Social Security Act, for example, was written by a Wisconsinite loyal to what became called the Wisconsin Idea, which was this idea of this pragmatic progressivism used to create a society more in balance, where there was still obviously capitalism, but some of the harder edges were softened for people. The other thing that was important was La Follette championed the idea that corporations should not be given too much influence in government. He wanted citizens to be the real drivers of their government, and so he limited corporate donations to candidates and other reforms that tried to create a culture of clean, transparent government. And that culture persisted for many, many decades. The state became called what Louis Brandeis, the Supreme Court Justice, called a laboratory of democracy, and it was probably the premier laboratory of democracy in the country. Other things that were championed there was the Medicare program, which was drafted by a Wisconsinite loyal to the Wisconsin Idea much later.
So Wisconsin has this reputation as a progressive bastion, and I think that that made it so more surprising in 2011 when Governor Scott Walker began pushing for what became known as Act 10. What was Act 10 trying to do?
Act 10 was a stripping away of virtually all the collective bargaining rights for public employees. It also instituted major cuts to the state's contribution to their pension and health care benefits. But the distinguishing feature was to take away their collective bargaining rights and to eliminate automatic dues collection, which weakened them financially. Now a union has to recertify itself each year They can only negotiate for wages and only then up to the cost of living index. So they basically took away their ability to have a collective voice in their employment. It was also, as many people saw, a political attack on both labor, but also by extension the Democratic Party, since labor contributes heavily to the Democratic Party. And Walker kind of admitted as much in 2011. He was quoted on tape. A documentary filmmaker captured him speaking to a billionaire donor named Diane Hendricks, who asked if Wisconsin would ever become a completely red state, a right-to-work state. And he said, you know, we're working on a bill for public employees, and that she should take note of that, and that the strategy they were going to use to make it right to work was divide and conquer. And in fact, 4 years later, after Act 10, he passed a right to work law, which affected the private sector unions. So Wisconsin went from a union membership of 14% in 2011 to 8% today. And that has a huge impact on elections. Unions are historically pillars of civil society. It also demoralized a lot of his opponents. And its effect is still being measured, I think, but it has succeeded to some degree in changing the political character of Wisconsin.
I'm curious about the lead up to this, because we here in Illinois, with Governor Bruce Rauner, he has often cited Governor Walker as a sort of model for what he'd like to do. And Governor Rauner, when he campaigned, did not really talk about things he wanted to change for labor unions, right? He, in fact, at one point he told the union audience that I have no specific agenda regarding labor or something along those lines.
And it's interesting because Walker did something similar in the 2010 campaign, although he had been a noted opponent of the labor unions as Milwaukee County executive. He never campaigned on Act 10. He said in an interview with the Oshkosh Northwestern, a newspaper in Oshkosh, that he would use collective bargaining to negotiate more contributions for health care and pension benefits. He never said anything about stripping workers of their collective bargaining rights. However, a lot of powerful organizations in a kind of national conservative infrastructure had been championing this, and these ideas were out there. And Walker took it the furthest. And as you say, it has been an inspiration to a lot of conservatives. In Iowa, just in 2017, they passed a very extreme version of Act 10, and which also included the police and fire departments, which Wisconsin's did not. And that is, there's a reason for that. You know, in the 2017, Grover Norquist cited Act 10 as the greatest reason that Donald Trump won Wisconsin. And he said that if it gets passed in 12 more states, the Democratic Party will cease to be a competitive power, essentially.
Can you expound on this idea that an attack on labor, particularly public employee unions, that is an attack on the Democratic Party?
Well, the public employee unions do give a lot of money to the Democratic Party. Policy-wise, they're more aligned. Now, that said, labor unions are also more than just a donation machine. They also provide a context for workers to discuss policy that affects them. They've also been historically very important to things like the civil rights movement and other sort of progressive causes. They've been a key component of the foot soldiers, the army of these movements. Dr. King said that, you know, without the support of Walter Reuther of the United Automobile Workers, you know, the civil rights movement would not have succeeded.
That's something in your book that struck me. I had never made that connection. You talk about visiting the house of a man named Jesse Barnes, and you said he had these two pictures, right? The famous I Am a Man photo of the Memphis sanitation workers next to a picture of some of the labor and other people protesting Act 10 in Wisconsin. And it never occurred to me that it was actually a government employee union that was doing the protest that Martin Luther King went, where he was eventually assassinated.
That's right, yeah. And Jesse Barnes is a really interesting man who really understood the value of labor to the African-American community. He was a factory worker at Delphi Automotive for about 30 years. And he has he owns his home. He has a car that he's very proud of that he bought with his first union wages. And he is somebody that really understood something about that connection. He actually went to this UAW camp in Michigan that Walter Reuther set up for automobile workers, where they got together with, there were African-American, white, Latino workers, and they all saw themselves more or less as having similar concerns, you know, wanting a better life for their children, wanting apprenticeships to develop themselves. And they saw the union as a champion of these things. They're really their only real champion of these things. And I think that that was an important thing that was lost about labor. There's been corruption, obviously, and other problems with unions. But overall, it's been one of the most important forces for progressive achievements in the United States and the civil rights movement more than anything, probably. And I think when you look at the Memphis strike, yes, it was supported by AFSCME, the same union that Governor Walker was attacked, a union that was actually founded in Madison in 1932. So this tradition of Wisconsin progressivism has resonated and been echoed across the country in very important ways. And I feel like some people have perhaps lost sight of the valuable contributions of labor towards the overall betterment of society as a whole, not just for their members, but people outside of that.
So how do we go from a world where the unions are sort of at the vanguard of civil rights, some more enthusiastically than others, you tell the story of this rise of conservative groups, you know, that culminates in, as you quote somebody as saying, that Governor Walker was successful in part because he transformed teachers into union members, right? And is able to union bosses as an epithet, which our own Governor Rauner did here in his primary campaign, at least. How do you get from
Absolutely.
That one point to the other?
Yeah. Well, I think it's a combination of things. One, Governor Walker instituted this bill in a time of real deep economic insecurity. It was still the financial crisis. The economy was terrible. Rural Wisconsin has been hurt for a long time. It's been depleted. You know, there's been a precipitous decline in dairy farms as mechanization and so on takes over. For example, there was 150,000 dairy farms after the Second World War, and now there's fewer than 9,000. There's a lot of anger in some of these communities. A lot of times the only people with health insurance may be the public employees. What Walker did was he stoked resentment against them. In his inaugural address, he said, you know, I'm paraphrasing it because I don't have the text in front of me, but he said the public employees can no longer be the haves and the taxpayers the have-nots. And unfortunately, on the other side, the Democratic side, there was not a real clear defense of the public sphere. I'll give you an example. The outgoing governor, Jim Doyle, a Democrat, had bragged in December 2010, just weeks before Walker was actually inaugurated, that he had cut more public employees than any governor in history. So this austerity idea and the turning away from public investment, which had always been a proud tradition in Wisconsin, partly because La Follette had made government service admirable, and it was a very clean, transparent. He had instituted reforms to keep political appointments from happening. He had separated it from the corrupting political process. That tradition had always been really strong. The scientists for the Department of Natural Resources, the University of Wisconsin was the crown jewel of the state and still is for many people. But this began to turn, and it wasn't just Scott Walker that that propagated this idea, but I think he took it very far. And resentment can catch fire when there's a wanting, you know, and you saw it play out in a different way in 2016, I think. But it was the same kind of principle. There's us and there's them. And unfortunately, he was able to succeed in dividing people who might be allies in other ways.
And the last thing before we move off of labor, this is, you talk about one of the must-haves, right? As the governor was, Governor Walker was negotiating Act 10, one of the must-haves was this idea of the automatic dues checkoff, right? That was the main thing,
the
fair share fees. And now here we are in 2018. That seems like a moot point, given what the Supreme Court did in its recent Janus versus AFSCME decision.
That is correct. One thing that I would say about Janus, though, was it was presaged by Walker's attacks on in Act 10 on Wisconsin's public employees, because you have to remember that once that succeeded, it started being replicated in other states. And just the whole idea, again, you don't have a strong a Democratic Party strongly opposing criticisms of public employees. In fact, Arne Duncan, the Secretary of Education, was quite critical of, in some regards, of some things that the teachers union was opposed to. But the rhetorical attack on public employees was widespread. And I think, Janice, obviously you have a very conservative Supreme Court, and that has its own logic. But it is true that now the country is, in a way, we're all Wisconsin now. And I'm not sure what kind of future that offers for regular middle-class people. You know, the other thing about unions that people forget is, like, higher wages for public employees or and private sector union members trickles down much more than, you know, tax breaks to wealthy people, because they spend that money in their communities. That's been proven by tons of economic research. And these cuts bring everyone down. You know what I mean? Even if there's only 15% union members, that will lift up the standards of an area because there's more money being spent in that area.
We're talking to Dan Kaufman, who's the author of The Fall of Wisconsin, The Conservative Conquest of a Progressive Bastion and the Future of American Politics. We're going to continue the conversation here on the 21st. Stay with us. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey, in for Nyla Boodoo. We're speaking with Dan Kaufman, who's the author of The Fall of Wisconsin, The Conservative Conquest of a Progressive Bastion and the Future of American Politics. I want to turn to some of these. We talked a little bit earlier about Wisconsin values, the Wisconsin idea. What are some of these things that Wisconsin brought to the nation in terms of progressive politics? We talked about labor already, but the environment was a big Wisconsin had a lot to do with.
Environment was a huge thing. Yes, right. In 1910, the state passed the first constitutional amendment in the state constitution that would the first kind of forest conservation effort, and that really the environmental spirit of the state really came out of the Wisconsin idea. Aldo Leopold, a very famous conservationist who wrote the Sand County Almanac, was a professor at the University of Wisconsin. He developed what became called the land ethic, and this influenced a very important senator and politician named Gaylord Nelson, who some of your listeners might remember, who was also the governor of Wisconsin. And Nelson really was probably the most, of the second half of the 20th century, the most important American environmentalist as far as raising the issue of the environment to one of the utmost importance. He, of course, famously founded Earth Day, but he did more than that. He was the one that developed a program to set aside hundreds of thousands, to use tax money from cigarettes, to set aside hundreds of thousands of acres of really special Wisconsin land for the public, like wetlands and so on. It was a real strong conservationist ethos that began to be grafted onto the state's identity. And this has been hugely eroded by Governor Walker, who's basically dismantled much of this and allowed corporations to even in some cases draft the bills that would directly benefit them. One of the key threads of my book is a battle between a Native American tribe and a mine near Lake Superior that would be a few miles from the reservation. And it became clear that the mining company, owned by a billionaire coal magnate from Florida, had in fact drafted portions of this bill. This was admitted to me by the Senate Majority Leader, Scott Fitzgerald. And it was quite revealing. The process itself has become corrupted to a point where citizens are not really a part of it. And nothing like that, that extreme, would ever have been passed in a normal process. But the Republican control is also ensured by gerrymandering and dark money. And again, this weak Democratic opposition, and it's been very effective.
And that's one of the themes in your book here, is that this is the Democrats in the state are often either reluctant to take on the issues when they come up. Even labor is divided, as you talked about, the division between the trade unions and government unions. This is, like I said, a consistent theme of people sort of having to take their resistance into their own hands.
Yeah, I think that that was something that emerged. I think there's some regrets around that among a lot of people. That one of my characters, Randy Bryce, who's running against or was running for the seat of Speaker of the House Paul Ryan, had a lot of people come up to him after, from his local and from the other building trades, that apologized for voting for Walker. They saw themselves as special, as different. And in fact, they were talked about that way by Walker, who had said he would not pass a right-to-work bill and then, of course, betrayed them. So there's regret around that. But, yeah, that's unfortunately been a successful tactic for the Republicans and splitting also the building trades. Some of them signed on to this mining legislation, supported it in the idea that Walker and the company had promised that union labor would be used. So they didn't see it as part of this political program that was ultimately damaging them as well. So unfortunately, yes, that has been effective. Now, I don't know. It might be shifting a bit, but, there's been a recent resurgence of Democratic Party success. There's a state Senate race won by a woman in a district that Trump won by 18 points. So I don't know. It's too soon to tell. But there's a lot of damage done to the state's progressive character that is going to be difficult to repair, I think.
In your view, damage inflicted by Governor Walker and his allies, or is it something that has changed fundamentally? Is the Wisconsin idea outdated, or has it died somehow?
You know, I tend to take the view that it was more inflicted, but it had faded. And unfortunately, people had taken it for granted in some ways, not seeing that such a kind of extreme attack might be possible. I mean, again, these ideas were not really developed in Wisconsin itself. It comes from these conservative think tanks and a long, decades-long effort to attack and diminish the public sphere. And it's a hard question to answer. They had a receptive audience, but the receptive audience was partly receptive because times were tough. And there was a lot of resentment that had built up because people were hurting and no one was offering an effective counter message that might have mitigated that.
Well, as I said earlier, Governor Bruce Rauner here has cited Governor Scott Walker in Wisconsin as an inspiration. And he didn't quite go as far as Governor Walker had when he first came into office. And of course, he did not have a Republican legislature who was willing to go along
right.
with him. And so we end up
not
having a budget for a few years. I wonder from, what are the takeaways for people outside of Wisconsin from your book, and particularly here in Illinois?
Yeah, I think it should be a wake up call to anyone. Look at the Midwest before you have. Now, Wisconsin, Michigan, Indiana, Iowa, all right-to-work states. The only exceptions are Minnesota and Illinois. That is an effort to kind of turn the industrial Midwest into a version of the South, where right-to-work laws have been very entrenched for decades. So I think, people in Illinois, I hope that they do read this book as a warning that not to take obviously, there's problems with unions, not saying they're perfect, but without a counterweight to the infrastructure on the right, it's very difficult to organize an effective opposition. And these changes can affect environmental things and many other things that a lot of people, particularly progressives, obviously care about. But even some Republicans, you know, a lot of Republicans in Wisconsin are not happy with the environmental changes that Walker has instituted. That was a bipartisan tradition, voting, the idea that people should be able to vote easily. That was a Wisconsin tradition. They wanted to encourage civic participation, and that has been lost. They have now instituted one of the strictest voter ID laws in the country. So these are things that I think most people could agree are good things. And I would urge people to take a look at a place that was once thought of as a blue wall. That may have been an exaggeration, but still had a fundamental progressive character. And people are still trying to restore it, and I don't want to leave just a hopeless message, because the book, the heart of the book, is about people that refuse to let go of that ideal. And I think that as long as they can persist and keep trying, I think there is a chance that some things that many Wisconsinites admired might be restored.
Well, Dan Kaufman, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks a lot.
Dan Kaufman is the author of The Fall of Wisconsin, The Conservative Conquest of a Progressive Bastion, and the Future of American Politics. Election Day is still about 3.5 months away, but elections have been in the news this week. And I'm not talking about politics, but rather the mechanics of elections. Last week, a grand jury in Washington, D.C. indicted 12 Russian military officers on charges related to the 2016 elections. Then, on Tuesday, Governor Bruce Rauner vetoed legislation that would have prohibited Illinois from participating in the controversial Interstate Cross-Check program. In one way or another, both of these stories involve the Illinois State Board of Elections. So we asked board spokesman Matt Dietrich to walk us through. Matt, welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you, Brian.
So last Friday, a bunch of us in the State House press room were scouring these Russia indictments, looking for mentions of Illinois. I gather you were doing the same. And there on page 26, count 72, it says a Russian intelligence officer named Anatoly Sergeyevich Kovalyov hacked the website of an unnamed state board of elections. It listed this as SBOE1. What went through your mind when you read that?
The first thing that went through my mind was I did a quick search of the indictment for Illinois, and I found one unrelated mention that didn't involve the State Board of Elections. Then I searched for voters, and that's when that popped up. And the first thing I thought of when I saw paragraph 72, of course, was, well, that's us. SBOE1, it happened in July of 2016. You know, we had our data breach in July 2016. We called the feds in immediately, the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security, and we'd been working with them ever since. So it was our assumption that that very likely was us. We don't have direct confirmation from them, but I think it'd be a little disingenuous for us to say, you know, to act like, oh, we really don't know, when we're pretty sure it is.
So refresh our recollection. What was it that was breached in this data breach back in the summer of 2016?
Yeah, it was 2 years ago. And what was breached is the statewide electronic voter registration database. An intruder had actually gotten into the database in late June. And then it was on July 12, 2016, that one of our IT people suddenly noticed that our whole system had slowed down to a crawl, and they very quickly diagnosed the problem that someone was in, and they were firing queries at our database at the rate of 5 per second, which was completely overwhelming the server. As it turned out, it was a programming error on our website that had been done. You know, it was just a case of human error, but that was very quickly closed. And almost immediately, we brought in federal investigators to help us with that investigation.
And ultimately, you said that, what was it, 76,000
right.
voter pieces of information were hacked. Of course, the indictment talks about 500,000. How did the state board come to its number, and you know, do you have any idea why it's different from what the feds are saying?
The Illinois Personal Information Privacy Act lays out conditions in which individuals whose personal information may have been compromised need to be notified. So we use that in determining the voters who warranted being informed that the intruders may have gotten a look at their information. Now, we did that by analyzing everything that went on during the breach, looking at the data. And keep in mind that when the intruder was in there, what he or she was getting was mostly fragments of voter registrations. So, you know, maybe a zip code, maybe a street name. That's what the bulk of it was. But there were some where we felt they may have had enough individual components of the registration that it warranted individual notification. We suspect that what the federal government is going on in the indictment with their number of 500,000, they refer to data related to voters. And we suspect that they're using the federal criminal code. In other words, what it very likely is that every single piece of data that was viewed by the intruder would constitute one more piece in that 500,000.
So 76,000 people, but because each one was a name, a date of birth,
right,
an address perhaps, that all counts as maybe a separate piece of information?
That's our theory. That's okay. Our theory. And we issued a press release where we said we are going to reach out to the Department of Justice to see if we can get some clarification on that. We've done that. We really don't expect to hear anything from them. You rarely do in these cases.
Yeah, but. Right. So do you have any idea what the Russians might have wanted to do with this data? What could they have? Could they have changed it? Could they have unregistered people?
They couldn't change it. They tried. They were unsuccessful in changing anything. And we have no way of guessing what their intent may have been. Now, if you look at the earlier federal indictment of the Russians who used social media to kind of interfere with the election from a few months ago, and if you look at statements that have come out from the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI, it seems logical to assume that what they really were after was, in any way they could, to undermine public confidence in this case, the election system in Illinois. Just by us, you know, knowing that we had been interfered with this way, it put us through having to inform people. We've been very open about what happened, why it happened. That could be viewed as a success for if you're looking at ways to get people to question, gosh, do I want to register to vote? Is my data safe? Which, by the way, it is. Do I want to vote? All these types of questions, that could go back to what the goal was. Now, had they been able to change records or interfere with, say, the poll books that your workers at your polling place have, that where they check off voters who come in, you could wreak some havoc that way. We don't think that they could have changed votes. That was totally unrelated to what happened. But undermining confidence, I think, would be the number one goal. That would be our working hypothesis here.
Yeah, and just briefly, because I want to get to the cross-check thing too, but I mean, these are not the same system. This is not tied into the system where it actually tabulates votes.
No, this is totally different from that. The voting system is never on the internet, and that's a completely different thing.
Okay, well, we've only got about a minute left, but I wanted to ask about Governor Rauner vetoed this bill that would have banned participation in the cross-check program. I know the Board of Elections deadlocked 4-4. There was a motion to withdraw Illinois from it. This is a program Democrats have criticized as something that's a voter suppression tool. It was created by the Kansas Secretary of State. What is the status? Is Illinois giving information to cross-check participating?
No, Illinois has been. We've been sort of dormant with cross-check since the fall, and we aired some concerns we had about their data handling. They said they were going to fix that. When we had our next contact with them, which was in, January, they said that they were waiting for the Department of Homeland Security to look over their system to give it the go-ahead, and they wouldn't be asking for data until then. We haven't heard from them since then. There's been a lot of turmoil surrounding cross-check. So right now, yeah, technically, we're in cross-check because our board didn't take us out and this bill's been vetoed. But realistically, we are dormant. We are just kind of in limbo with cross-check at the moment.
All right. Thanks for your time. Matt Dietrich is spokesman for the Illinois State Board of Elections. Matt, thanks for coming back on the 21st.
Thank you, Brian.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey, in for Nyla Boodoo.
In ancient Rome, the gladiators went into the arena with these words on their lips. Let me win, but if I cannot win, let me be brave in the attempt. Today, all of you young athletes are in the arena. Many of you will win, but even more important, I know you will be brave and bring credit to your parents and to your country. Let us begin the Olympics. Thank you.
That's Eunice Kennedy Shriver speaking to a crowd gathered at Soldier Field back in 1968. She was talking to more than 1,000 athletes and spectators who were awaiting the start of the first ever Special Olympics. Just a few years earlier, when a Chicago Park District PE teacher started working with kids, there was no special education for kids with disabilities. At that time, the 23-year-old teacher, named Ann Burke, had an idea to create a sporting event devoted to kids with intellectual disabilities. With the help of Eunice Kennedy Shriver, Ann Burke planned and launched the Special Olympics, which is now celebrating its 50th anniversary this week in Chicago. Of course, now you may know Ann Burke has been an Illinois Supreme Court justice since 2006. Before that, she served on the Illinois Appellate Court. Justice Burke is on the line with us now to talk about the history of the Special Olympics and some of the events that they're having this week to celebrate its 50th anniversary. Justice Burke, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Brian. I'm thrilled to be here.
So, Justice, how did the idea to start the Special Olympics first come to you? What was it like working with kids in 1968?
Well, actually, I started in 1965. It was interesting. In 1965, Eunice Kennedy, who actually lived in Chicago, was Sarge Shriver. He was head of our Board of Education at one point in time. She was best friends with Richard J. Daley. And you know her background because of her sister with Rosemary. She asked Richard J. Daley if he would consider opening up the Chicago parks to children and adults with differences, intellectual disabilities. And she attached a $10,000 grant with it. And, of course, Mayor Daley said, of course, we can do that. You know, at that time, nobody knew who these people were because they were in the back room of somebody's home or they were in institutions. And as you have already stated, there was no special education. There was no special recreation. And the Americans with Disabilities Act didn't exist. But I was a phys ed teacher in the parks. I taught kids how to run, jump, swim, tap dance, twirl the baton, all the things I love to do. So that was the greatest thing in the whole world, is to have a career doing what you love to do. And I just started teaching kids with disabilities in our parks. And we did competition because that's a normal thing to do when you teach sports skills. You have relay races, you throw a ball, you run, jump, whatever it takes, and you teach them how to swim. So when the president of the park district had come to my park and had seen what these kids were doing, this was in 67, he said, well, how many kids live here in Chicago that are like this? And at that time, nobody knew. Nobody knew around the country how many people with intellectual disabilities existed because no one talked about it. And he asked, what could we do? And I said, well, we should do what we do with our regular day camp and have a sports competition in Soldier Field at the end of day camp and have all the parks come together, the 10 parks, with special children and adults, and we'll have a sports competition. Well, he said, okay, you're in charge, put it together. and you know, 23 years old, and I'm a college dropout. I only went 1 year to college at that time. So I called on the other park district employees who were professionals and athletes themselves, knowing that they had put even the Pan Am games together. So it wasn't a daunting situation for me because I knew I had the park district backup. But what bothered me was that I didn't know anything about, well, nobody really knew too much about people with intellectual disabilities, but I knew there was a man at Southern Illinois University who had been a former director of the Kennedy Foundation. Mm-hmm. I phoned him. His name, Dr. William Freeberg, and I asked him to come up to Chicago to consult with me because I wanted to do a track meet. He did, and he liked the idea, and he said, you ought to call or write a proposal to Mrs. Eunice Kennedy Shriver. She might want to fund this. So that's exactly what I did. I wrote a proposal attached to my letter, and she called back and said she wanted me to come to Washington to talk about it with her. Well, of course, you know, this is President Kennedy's sister. I was 23 years old, and I didn't have my college degree. I never even thought in my wildest dreams that anyone would pay attention to me, being not qualified, so to speak. But
you know, that's such a good point, because I mean, you're such a well-known figure now and part of an important family in Illinois politics, obviously. But I think that maybe people don't remember a time before that, right? So this is you're just
right.
A 23-year-old college dropout writing to one of the Kennedy people.
Yes, right. I was, you know, really it was a daunting thought. But that whole point, Brian, is why I think is important for all of us to think about, is when I did see her, she liked my proposal, but she told me it was unacceptable.
Huh.
Well, that really deflated me. But then she finished. She said, "Anne, it's unacceptable because it's only a citywide track meet. It could be better, it could be larger, it could be national. If you rewrite this proposal, then you will get my help." So I went home, rewrote it, and then she funded the first games. But isn't that a great message from somebody? I mean, the whole idea of something being unacceptable, even though it was good, everything can be better.
And bigger.
And
you need a bigger
life,
vision. You need a broader vision.
Right.
Yeah.
My whole life, it was unacceptable. I didn't have my college degree. I went back to college. It was unacceptable. My husband said, "You know a lot about people with intellectual disabilities. You'd be a better advocate for them if you got a law degree." So I went back to law school. So all of those things were based on Mrs. Shriver's words to me.
And can you talk a little bit more about her? I think, you know, some listeners may not be familiar. You mentioned her sister Rosemary. There was Camp Shriver in 1962. Why was this an mm-hmm. important issue to her?
Well, she comes from a big family, and Rosemary Eunice actually recognized early on as a younger child, and she being relatively young too, that her little sister had some slowness about her, because the Kennedy family was always very competitive, and especially in sports, and Rosemary kind of tagged along. But it became clearer and clearer as she got to be 5 years old and 6 years old when going to school, she was lagging behind. So Eunice actually was her caretaker, her caregiver. As the other kids progressed, she recognized even more that there was something wrong. And she, at that time, you know, it was a long time ago, nobody knew very much about people with intellectual disabilities other than, we don't know what to do, so you're going into an institution. And so, but Eunice, her whole life, was a mentor for getting more things done for people with intellectual disabilities. And it was her vision early on because of her sister. So when she saw that the Park District in Chicago, after she funded us with $10,000, really came up with an idea for competition, she grabbed onto it. So
yeah.
And now today, as we sit here and celebrate tomorrow, the 50th anniversary of the first games, you know, there were people in the field, 1,000 kids from all 26 states and Canada, international games, so to speak, but no one in the stands because we got pushback. I got terrible pushback when I was asking people for help. I went to Tribune Charities and asked for some help. They yelled at me, "Who do you think you are putting these people on display?" I asked National Parks and Recreation. They would not endorse us. But we went ahead and did it. We went ahead and did it anyway. And look what it did to the world. It changed the world's thinking and the stigma connected with intellectual disabilities.
Well, I wanted to ask you about how the attitude and the rhetoric around people with these disabilities has changed over time. I mean, that's remarkable, I think, to somebody listening today to think that you would say, "No, we don't want to do this. Leave these people in the back rooms of the house, in the institutions."
Mm-hmm.
It's been a sea change.
It's been a sea change, but you have to really credit, I think, the parents, because the parents were the ones who were told when their child was born, "This child will amount to nothing." It gave them no hope. So when they saw their kids in our park program and all the abilities they had, they learned to run, they learned to jump, they learned their colors, and they learned to play, actually even in teams. They were amazed because they were told by the medical profession, and I'm not bashing, and this is just the way it was at that time. Nobody knew anything about these people. They began to have hope, and then they began to really get other parents to bring their kids. And the movement just, it was like a contagious infection. It just kept on moving and growing. And only the Kennedy family could make it a worldwide event. It really is beautiful. This week has been over the top for me, and I suppose tomorrow will even be worse when I'm in Soldier Field. when they bring the torch light. Now, this is, last week, Tuesday, I was in Hyannisport. It was Eunice's birthday, July 10th. At that time, the Greek ambassador brought the cylinder that is placed on the ground that captures the sunlight to heat the cylinder, a metal cylinder, where the torch is lit. Just put a torch in there, and it lights automatically.
Huh.
That torch was lit on the Hyannisport lawn, where we all have seen in the movies and in pictures where the Kennedy kids played. That was brought, it's being brought today on United Airlines in a special cylinder to Chicago to have the law enforcement officers from around the world run down Lakeshore Drive into Soldier Field and light the eternal flame of hope that was created by Richard Hunt, a Chicago international well-known sculptor, and it will be lit with an eternal flame right from Greece.
Wow. Wow. That's remarkable. So you're going to be at Soldier Field 50 years ago. I'm wondering, you mentioned 1,000 participants. Today it's 5 million in all these various events all over the world. But 50 years ago, what does it feel like to be at Soldier Field, the smell of the grass? Take us back there.
It was a very hot day back July 20th, 1968. You felt like you were in an oven, and we're hoping it's going to be the same way tomorrow, except and not rain or anything. But even if it does, it would make no difference because there's 25 countries in Chicago right now. And so people from around the world are coming, and delegations are coming from around the world to celebrate. The princess from Abu Dhabi came in and her team who the other day to talk to me. That country is only 46 years old, and they've embraced Special Olympics. They're going to have the World Games next year in Abu Dhabi. So we have people from all over the world playing unified soccer. The World Cup unified soccer game is going to be played tomorrow night. So these 25 teams from around the world are playing right now in preparation of who's going to play the final World Cup games tomorrow. It's beyond any kind of thought for me. I mean, I'm just soaking it all in. I don't know how I will react to any of it, but I'm just so glad to have been a part of it, a small part of it, along with the people today who have carried the torch for 50 years and working very hard. Mm-hmm. Most of them don't even know or weren't even born then, about history. So we're happy to talk about it now and have them remember, because we always learn from history, never to revert back to the way things were, I hope.
Yeah, well, we've got just about a minute left. Any other things you're looking forward to, some of the events that are taking place in the next day or two to remember this?
Yeah. Yes. Well, besides the World Cup soccer games and the lighting of the eternal flame of hope, which will be huge, then on Saturday, the 21st, at Soldier Field, it's the World Day of Inclusion. Now, this is the mantra we're hoping will go forward in the next 50 years, is that inclusion is so important. People with intellectual differences side by side on the same team and in society with those who have no intellectual differences. And that's what the World Inclusion World Cup is about. Going forward. And I hope that, ultimately we'll have good housing, long-term residential care, higher education for people with intellectual differences. So we have a lot to do yet. And so what was ignited in 1968 will continue this movement to go forward to make sure that we have true equality for people with intellectual differences.
Ann Burke is a justice on the Illinois Supreme Court. Back in the mid-1960s, she also planned and helped found the Special Olympics. Justice Burke, thanks so much for speaking with us today on the 21st.
Thank you, Brian, for having me.
That's it for the 21st today. You can follow us on Twitter. Search for 21ST Show. We live tweet during the show. Also, search for the 21st on Facebook. Every way to contact us is on our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montecilio. Tyler Panlilio is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. I'm Brian Mackey, in for Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.